Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Hope you're having a nice day. We have a lot of information to share, including how childhood bullying can lead to increased chronic disease risk in adulthood. A study from the Mayo Clinic published in Harvard Review of Psychiatry, and ways that celery, yes, regular celery, will destroy cancer cells. A good study there also. Then we're going to talk about the Mayo Clinic discovers high-intensity aerobic training can reverse aging processes. Wow. And that's published in Cell Metabolism. And then also, kind words can prime the body's response to pain. Pennsylvania State University. Well, I think that would be true for anything, don't you? We always like to hear kind words rather than harsh words. And probiotics and yogurt reverse depression. Wow. University of Virginia School of Medicine. Also today, from our audio file, we're going to have some clips that I think are important, including a Canadian journalist destroying corporate media's hacks and explains what actually is going on in Aleppo, Syria. She was there during the fighting, the liberation of it. She has spoken with hundreds of civilians there. And this is a classic example of the deep state and the deep state's hidden hand, where they control the message. They create the conflict. It did not exist. They then supply the weapons, the training, the intelligence, boots on the ground, because they think in real short order Assad will be wiped away, and then they'll have the entire region completely under control, with the exception of Iran, but not to worry, with our allegiances over there. Israel will knock out Iran, and then the whole Middle East will be in the hands of Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Syria, and Israel. Didn't work that way. But we were lied to, just like Iraq didn't work that way, and Afghanistan didn't work that way, and Vietnam didn't work that way. In fact, nothing has worked the way it was supposed to be. We've been lied to, and the media is absolutely complicit. CNN, the New York Times, MSNBC, and even Pacifica. So we're going to play someone who tells you the truth. Also, from my home state of West Virginia, I had an opportunity, being a hillbilly, to live amongst the people, to know what it's like, their language, their customs, what they value. And boy, have they been misunderstood, and especially by those who condemned them because they voted for Trump. And when I hear the slurs and the prejudice and just the foolishness, the people who've never been to the area, never spoken with the people, have no idea what it's like to wake up each morning and the kind of pain, emotional pain, feeling completely abandoned by everyone. So today, we're going to take you to one town, Kermit, tiny little town of 400 people, down in the end of West Virginia. Also, we're going to look at nutrition and criminal behavior from Dr. Russell Blaylock, examines the link between crime and diet. I want you to know that black cumin seeds, according to the latest research I just mentioned yesterday, does a lot more than helping with thyroid, especially hypothyroidism. A recent clinical trial indicates that the most common cause of hypothyroidism, or Hashimoto's disease, may be ameliorated with the addition of only 2 grams of powdered black seed oil daily. 2 grams is tiny, 28 grams to an ounce. You're dealing with, you know, an eighth of a teaspoon. That's how small amount. Or about, I would, instead of taking the powder, I'd take the oil, a half a teaspoon. So for all of you who have that, You could be helping yourself. And this was a new, powerful, randomized clinical trial, and that revealed the ancient healing food known as Nigella sativa, or meaning black seed, once known as the remedy for everything but death, may provide an ideal treatment for the autoimmune thyroid condition known as Hashimoto's disease, which is the most common cause of hypothyroidism. And the study was published in the British Medical Journal Complementary and Alternative Medicine. So that's important. Also, it turns off inflammation everywhere in the body. I recommend it for everyone with any form of brain condition, from depression to Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia, ALS, multiple sclerosis. That I would suggest more, but it really makes a difference turning off inflammation. And athletes also take it after a workout. This is published in the Harvard Review of Psychiatry. It's about being bullied, and especially being bullied during childhood, that might have lifelong health effects related to chronic stress exposure, including an increased risk of heart disease and diabetes in adults. And recent advances in understanding the negative health effects of chronic stress highlight a pressing need to clarify the long-term health implications of childhood bullying. And that's what this study did. Quote, bullying as a form of chronic social stress may have significant health consequences if not addressed early. We encourage child health professionals to assess both the mental and physical health effects of bullying. Quote, once dismissed as an innocuous experience of childhood, bullying is now recognized as having significant psychological effects, particularly with chronic exposure. Okay, what we now know is this. Bullied children also have increased rates of recurrent and unexplained symptoms that should have been a sign that this was from bullying. And it's important that we appreciate the biological process linking these psychological and physiological phenomena, including their long-term effect on our health. So once you can understand that they can lead to inflammation, hormonal and metabolic responses, and over time these physiological alterations can contribute to the development of disease, depression, diabetes, heart disease. So if you have a child who has been bullied, or if you have been bullied when you look back as a child, humanistic psychological therapy can help. There's a Dr. Grayson, and Dr. Grayson, who is a PhD in psychology, created what is called a tapping process, and I have it in one of the documentaries. Henry Grayson is his name. You can look him up. And I've seen it. I took a group of people to him to test for myself if it worked, and these were people who all had been sexually traumatized and abused, men and women, when they were young. He was able to do this tapping and talking so that they would repeat. They would repeat certain statements while they were tapping different parts of their body, depending upon how they were abused and where the abuse was manifesting. And in every single case, all of their symptoms, their moods, their thoughts, completely changed. And then I contacted these people over 6 months, and it stayed changed. So that, you know, that told me that it's a good technique. So helping you if you've been bullied or abused, try that tapping technique. And I believe he's done a documentary on it or a video. So look under Henry Grayson, PhD, and see if you can find any of the video links, because it's something you can teach yourself. Also, celery doesn't have much of a taste, has a great crunch, and so we're told it has very little nutritional value. It's simply not true. Celery is extremely important, and celery juice is the most common juice that I advocate for people. In fact, virtually everyone who wants to detoxify and cleanse their system, I advocate starting with one 16-ounce glass made up principally of celery and cucumber and green apple. Later, you add lemon, ginger, but the celery is what does it, especially people with cancer. Why? Because although celery is rich in many beneficial compounds, its premier cancer-fighting constituents are it's a flavonoid called apigenin. Apigenin, which has been impressing researchers with its powerful chemo-preventative effects. Again and again, in both cell and animal studies, apigenin was found to inhibit the initiation and progression and metastasis of tumors. And apigenin fights cancer at every stage with multiple mechanisms of action. So it's extremely versatile at what it does in the body. So, in fact, the versatility is important because it may help to overcome the natural genetic variations that make some patients unable to benefit from a single chemotherapy compound if that chemotherapy actually benefited them. Apigenin prevents and suppresses and even reverses cancer in several distinct ways. What is called angiogenesis, that's the growth of new blood vessels to nourish tumors, is an important process in the proliferation of cancer. Well, apigenin has been found to inhibit angiogenesis, thus depriving tumors of blood and oxygen and nutrients they need to survive. In a cell study, apigenin helped to starve human pancreatic cancer cells by depriving them of glucose, which is needed to fuel cancer's rampant growth. And apigenin also interferes with molecular signaling, decreasing the production of chemicals needed for cancer cells. In fact, in a study published in Carcinogenesis, apigenin inhibited the expression of focal adhesion kinase, or what is called FAK. That's a protein essential to cancer's ability to break down and invade healthy tissue, thereby inhibiting the metastatic growth of ovarian cancer cells. In another study, researchers found that apigenin protected pancreatic cells from inflammatory conditions and cancer-causing damage produced by cytokines. So, in every way, this single nutrient found in celery can make an enormous difference. So, something new. And finally, from the Mayo Clinic, now everyone in this audience knows that exercise is good for you. But what type of training helps most, especially when you're older, over the age of 40? The Mayo Clinic study says it's high-intensity aerobic exercise which can reverse some cellular aspects of aging. And it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell Metabolism. And the Mayo researchers compared high-intensity interval training and resistance training and combined training. And all training types improve lean body mass, burn fat, and help with insulin sensitivity. But only one, high-intensity and combined training, improved aerobic capacity and mitochondrial function of skeletal muscle. And remember, declining of the mitochondrial content and function are common as you age. So the high-intensity intervals also improve muscle protein content, not only enhanced energetic functions, but also cause muscle enlargement. That's important. You start losing your muscle after 40, so you get your muscle back. So you improve your mitochondria, you have more energy. You improve your muscle strength, you improve your muscle size, you improve your skeletal muscle gene expression. All good. And all, let me not forget this from Pennsylvania State University. Kind words can prime the body's response to pain. That's according to a professor. So unless he's the doctor, there isn't much a person can do except when it comes to sickness, except kind of be there to give witness to it. But we've all seen that most of the time people talk almost in a depressed, saddened, or in a kind of giving up. Where I grew up, if a person was diagnosed with cancer, well, they got the big C, they're going to die. It didn't have to be that way. But I think even the patient believed that they had cancer, they were going to die. So they just kind of accepted it. In fact, when my Uncle George, who kind of was the overseer of all of our family, when he got cancer, we were all invited into the room to say our goodbyes to him. And I was in college at the time, and I said, well, why does he have to die? Isn't there any other way? No, you know, Gary, when you get cancer. So all my in-laws were in the out room waiting their turn to go in and say their goodbye, and I went in too, and I said, isn't there something else? Isn't there another hospital you can go to? And he said, no. He said, when you have cancer, it's time to go. And there was nothing I could say at that point. Now we know that having kind words that encourage people make all the difference. When you're in the New York City Marathon and the gun goes off, everybody is like Mardi Gras. It's one great party. If you've never been to Mardi Gras, you don't have to do the drinking, but boy, you can enjoy the food. Some of the finest food in the world is down there, the people, the music. In fact, on one street, on Bourbon Street one night, I've gone to about 10 Mardi Gras, I walked up one block, just one block, and there were 8 different types of music going on. Every kind of music, from the deep bayou music, Cajun music, you can hear it all. And the people are just having a great time. In any case, one of the things that you notice when you start a marathon, it's like a Mardi Gras, a party. Laughing and cheering up the Verrazano Bridge, down the bridge, and then you see the first people. But then go to the 20th mile when you're going up First Avenue, and you start to realize, man, you don't hear anything because everyone is just, can I make it? Did I go out too fast? Did I train enough? My leg is sore. Should I slow down? All these thoughts are going through your mind. And then you have all these people along the sidewalk cheering you on. And their energy and their words, you can do it, keep going, almost there. You hear them 1,000 times, but the fact that you're hearing from other people and you look over and you see them pumping their arms in the air, you can do it, you can do it. Suddenly you get this burst of energy and it gets you another mile. And then your buddies that you're running with, they encourage you. So at every level of life, kind words to motivate us, whether it's in the healing process or whether it's in anything else we're doing, can make all the difference. And that's what this study showed. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and healing. As always, we like to give you the latest and cutting edge and all from peer review. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Also able to download the shows over the telephone as well. So we're very happy that we have Zeno Radio providing us with these phone numbers. If you want to listen live Monday to Friday, noon to 1, and Tuesday evening, 7 to 8, got a powerful ex-CIA agent on Progressive Commentary Hour. You don't want to miss that. Do not miss this. You're going to learn so many things that no one has told you about the CIA. And all the things dirty and bad that they have done, they have no credibility. They should be disbanded. But again, let me give you the phone number. It is 701-801-3662, 701-801-3662. But if you just want to go to the archives, because you don't have time to listen Monday to Friday, noon to 1, you can listen at any time you want, 701 701- 719 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. And a lot of people are not aware that we are not live on WBAI. The station manager has chosen, which is his right, to exercise suppression of freedom of speech, which again is his right, and it's very appropriate for free speech radio to not have free speech, but that's, you know, that's nothing new. So they're just playing repeats until they decide, and I decide what we're going to do, and I'll be making that decision within the next week, and then they won't be able to hear any more repeats. But in any case, right now you're listening live, and so you're getting the latest of the latest. Now, one of the things I'm very concerned about, before we go to our audio clips, I'm concerned about no one is paying attention to who the real enemies, who the real hidden hand, who the real deep state represent. It's the financial services industry, because everything has to be financed, whether it's pharmaceutical companies or these major hedge funds or equity partnerships. Someone has to be able to create the debt that allows people to profit. Now, of course, they won't give you and I that money, but they give billions, hundreds of billions, to people who never have to worry about paying it back. They use it to grow. And they're almost, to a group, corrupt. I want to share some insights from the European Financial Review by Graham Van Bergen, because it gives us an understanding. I believe that the Glass-Steagall Act should be reinstated. I believe there should be banks that are only for savings and personal individual loans, not corporate loans, and that they cannot take risks and they have to have a high reserve currency, meaning they can't be speculating, they can't print money out of thin air. And I believe also that there should be a law banning derivatives, and the American public should have the right to see all the big financial institutions that are heavily leveraged and in debt broken up and bankrupted and dissolved. They are a crisis waiting to happen. In fact, the top 10 banks in the United States, along with their European counterparts, have racked up over $300 billion in fines. And recently I gave you each bank and how much they paid in fines. Well, here's a simple question for you. If you walked into an employer and says, "Hi, my name's Bob, and I'm here to, you know, really do good for you." "Oh, Bob. Bob, I'm looking at your resume. You dress nice. You look nice. Have a nice voice. But I'm saying, Bob, that you, every single place you've worked, you've stolen from the company. You lie. You manipulate. And then when you're caught, you give a little bit of it back, about 1% of the money you stole, and then you go on to another company. You've done this 300 companies in the last year." "Yeah, well, hey, that's what it is. And there's no crime against committing a crime if you're rich in a famous corporation. You just pay a fine, right?" You'd think twice about hiring Bob. Why do we put our money in banks that have paid fines for bribing and currency manipulation, commodity manipulation, everything you could do that shows an egregious criminality? We accept. We just accept it, just like surveillance state. We accept it. We shouldn't. Well, what we have now is we didn't learn anything from the 2008 crisis as it unfolded. Nope. What we have now is we have everything ready to collapse. And that's unfortunate. But that's what I believe is going to happen in the next 24 months. And this is no better demonstrated than through a WikiLeaks release, where we learn that the banking giant Citigroup played a pivotal role in bringing America and the West to its knees, receiving the largest U.S. taxpayer bailout to resuscitate its insolvent corpse. It played a leading role in shaping and even staffing Barack Obama's first term in office by donating millions to his election campaign. So just understand, Citigroup, where Robert Rubin once reigned, Citigroup gives millions of dollars to get Obama elected. Obama gets elected and immediately allows the top person at Citigroup to select his entire cabinet. Well, and these are all pro-industry people. Now, when Donald Trump did the same thing, everyone called him out on the poor quality and background experience or the conflict of interest in his cabinet, and rightly so. But no one did it with Barack Obama. So what we have now is we have the biggest banks are now so powerful that they control all of our body politic. Not only did the biggest banks have the unrestrained power to destroy the global economy in a way that politicians could not, they then forced the entire political system across the West to stop all work in progress and hand over $21 trillion over this period of time and threatened that society would be ruined if they didn't get the money. The cost of this immense crisis is actually incalculable, not least unemployment for millions, lost wages, depletion of savings and retirement funds, mass asset repossessions, but also in hard cash to the taxpayer. In the U.S., this crisis is estimated to have cost somewhere between $12 and $22 trillion. Now, name me the person that went to jail for orchestrating this. Alan Greenspan? All of his economists? No. The head of any of the major banks? No. Nope. The Treasury Secretary, the top economist who approved all this on the President's Economic Council? No. No, in an extraordinary discussion at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C., called the Kleptocracy Initiative, experts and authors and academics debated how the financial services industry is wreaking havoc on the global economy and how they pose a serious threat to international peace and security. Here's what they concluded. One, corruption now lies at the very center of the entire global economy that subsequently affects many geopolitical outcomes. Two, the end of the Cold War and the expansion of globalization has been the perfect environment for an escalating level of global financial criminality. Three, the wealth defense industry has morphed into a corruption defense industry. And four, democracy and the rule of law in the West are being seriously undermined by the financial services industries. So the result is about 40% of the global gross domestic product, or $32 trillion, lies in offshore tax havens, much of it illegally managed by the Western financial services industry. So the industry evolved from what was the wealth defense industry that provided tax reduction, services to individuals and corporations at the end of the Cold War in 1991. And since the acceleration of globalization, we now have a corruption defense industry providing the same services to the same clients, but extended to include safe havens for their ill-gotten or criminal gains of the many tyrants and autocrats, corrupt government officials, and criminals around the world. It transpires that 40% of the funds in the British Virgin Islands is from the People's Republic of China. And also, it is now known that 50% of Russia's entire wealth is held offshore, and so is 30% of all African wealth, the vast majority administered and managed by Western financial services industries. And a recent Global Financial Integrity report stated that, quote, illicit financial flows from developing and emerging economies from 2004 to 2013 lost $7.8 trillion in illicit financial flows, increased at an average of 6.5% per year, more than twice as fast as global gross domestic product. So around $1 trillion is leaving developing nations each year and entering the West, stolen from African healthcare budgets, HIV/AIDS budgets, China's Health Standards Board, and nations all across take their ill-gotten money, their bad money, their dirty money, and they hide it. And they're hiding it using the services of American banks. And developing Europe, including very corrupt nations like Bulgaria, Hungary, Croatia, Poland, and Romania, they're all corrupt, plus 15 neighboring nations such as Albania, corrupt, Armenia, corrupt, account for nearly 26% of the illicit financial flows into tax havens and Western banks. And you name me a corrupt politician, a despotic leader, a senior member of Al-Qaeda, they all have money in these offshore accounts. So why do we continue to allow it? Why can't we close them down? Why can't we have a single tax, let's say 10%? They get to keep 90. The budgets of every country get 10%. Well, if you're looking at $30 trillion, that's $3 trillion that would suddenly be available. And yet we don't even talk about this. We don't talk about derivatives. We don't talk about the new bubbles, corporate real estate bubble. All across America, stores are closing. Malls are closing. I went into one of the most beautiful malls, and one of the first major malls, very upscale mall, in Florida, in Naples, Florida. Wasn't a single one of the 120 places had anyone in. They've been closed for years. And this is happening all across the country. Stores are closing down, and yet the rents have not come down. So you've got a big bubble that's about to burst, and you have a credit card bubble about to burst, a student loan that will burst, and we're not addressing any of these. And who does all this money belong to? It is owed to the banks. Are these the same banks that we bailed out when they were insolvent? Yes. So why don't we forgive those loans? We could, but we won't, unless we, the people, have enough third parties to form coalitions and work towards universal health care so everyone's covered. And I'm going to deal with that on tomorrow's show, how to do it and do it inexpensively and depth. And so that we don't have banks controlling our lives. We don't have debtors' prisons. We could close all this down if we chose to. Just some thoughts for you to think about. Now, we're going to go to one of our audio clips now. Here is an audio clip from a Canadian journalist that you have not seen on any of the media in the United States because she would quite simply destroy the arguments of the CNN pro-war pundits and the fascists over Fox News. Are there any other than the pro-war-loving people at Fox? Here's what she has to say about Syria and Aleppo.
When you talk about the Syrian people and what the Syrian people want, how can you quantify that? Do you have any independent surveys where you can actually document that? And secondly, you talk about the corporate media, the Western media, the lies, and all of this. Could you explain what you think might be the agenda from us in the Western media? And why we should lie, why the international organizations on the ground should lie, why we shouldn't believe all these absolutely documentable facts that we see from the ground, these hospitals being bombed, these civilians who are talking about the atrocities that they have been experiencing. How can you justify calling all of us liars?
Sure.
Thank you.
I mean, there are certainly honest journalists amongst the very compromised establishment media. Let's start with your second question. So international organizations on the ground. Tell me which ones are on the ground in Eastern Aleppo. Yeah, okay, I'll tell you, there are none. There are none. These organizations are relying on the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is based in Coventry, UK, and which is one man. They're relying on compromised groups like the White Helmets, which let's talk about the White Helmets. The White Helmets were founded in 2013 by a British ex-military officer. They have been funded to the tune of $100 million by the US, UK, and Europe and other states. They purport to be rescuing civilians in Eastern Aleppo and Idlib, yet no one in Eastern Aleppo has heard of them. And I say no one, bearing in mind that now 95% of these areas of Eastern Aleppo are liberated. The White Helmets purport to be neutral, yet they can be found carrying guns and standing in the dead bodies of Syrian soldiers. And their video footage actually contains children that have been recycled in different reports. So you can find a girl named Aya who turns up in a report in month, say, August, and she turns up in the next month in two different locations. So they are not credible. The SOHR is not credible. Unnamed activists are not credible. Once or twice, maybe, but every time, not credible. So your sources on the ground, you don't have them. As for your agenda, not your, but the agenda of some corporate media, it is the agenda of regime change. How can the New York Times, I was reading it this morning, or how can Democracy Now!, which I was reading the other day, maintain until this day that this is a civil war in Syria? How can they maintain until this day that there were that the protests were unarmed and nonviolent until, say, 2012? That is absolutely not true. How can they maintain that the Syrian government is attacking civilians in Aleppo when every person that's coming out of these areas occupied by terrorists is saying the opposite? How do I quantify the support of the Syrian people? The elections. In 2014, the Syrian people held elections, the point being, overwhelmingly, the people support President Assad. There are people that want change in the government. We're not pretending they don't want change. Everybody wants change. But in terms of support of the government, the point is they don't see President Assad as the problem. They see the problem as terrorism. They see elements of problems in the system that they have there. But President Assad, they don't see as the problem. They actually overwhelmingly support him. So I'm basing it on their choice in their leader, and I'm basing it on my interactions with people in Syria.
Interesting insights. And clearly, we would rather hear from a person that's never been in a war zone, but who is supported by a pro-war philosophy or think tanks that pay them, and instead of the person who's actually there. When you look at how many people voted for Donald Trump, a lot of these same people voted for Barack Obama because he promised them change. He promised when he made those trips through West Virginia that he would reindustrialize the area. He didn't. He didn't do a thing for them. So when someone offered to do something for them, of course they're going to vote for him. Doesn't mean they like him. It means that maybe this is the politician who will actually honor their word. Now, of course, there's a lot of things you can do for a very distressed state like West Virginia and Appalachia. You could bring in other industries. You could bring in the food industry. You could grow so much because there's hot springs in West Virginia. You could use geothermal. You could use wind. You could use solar. You could use combinations. You could grow in hydroponic. You could grow enough food to feed millions of Americans and then use that as the new breadbasket that is not impacted by weather and ship it out. All those people would have full employment. There'd be no unemployed people. And it would help the region. The whole economy would rise. That's doable. But they're not going to be helped by Donald Trump. They're not going to be, they weren't helped by any Democrat. So along comes the so-called corporate liberal community and denigrates them. These are the untouchables, as if they were in Indian class caste system, the deplorables. Well, have you actually, Hillary Clinton, have you actually spent time, spent a day with them, had a meal with them, see what they eat, see what they watch on television, see how they talk with each other? No, you haven't. Well, these are the people I grew up with. And I know as much about a West Virginian as any human being on the planet. Because I'm a keen observer, I'm a native, I went to high school and college there, graduated, my family still lives there. So boy, do you all make a mistake by assuming that you understand the fact that someone voted for someone, they're just like them. They're not. But they also don't have anything to look forward to. They have no hope. So a lot of them take drugs. Here's a story about 9 million painkillers shipped to one tiny West Virginia town in just 2 years. Listen in.
All in America, Bernie Sanders in Trump country. We're headed to McDowell County, West Virginia, way down the southern part of the state, the heart of coal country. Like many parts of the U.S., a lot of them poor, rural, largely white, West Virginia has been ravaged by a flood of opioids, highly addictive drugs that range from heroin to legal painkillers like Vicodin or Oxycontin. The state has the highest rate of overdose deaths in the entire country by a long shot. The president of the United States has promised to put an end to the crisis. But when he talks about where it came from, he's got it all wrong. We went to West Virginia to investigate.
This is Kermit, West Virginia. Population, just under 400. And this was the Save Right Pharmacy in Kermit, where at least 9 million opioid painkillers were shipped in just 2 years. 9 million. That's the equivalent of over 22,000 pills for every person in town. People came from all over the region to get drugs in Kermit.
A lot of traffic from different states where people were coming in getting their prescriptions filled because they heard that this was an easy place to get it filled, so this is where they came to.
Those drugs didn't come over the border from Mexico. They were manufactured by American firms, prescribed by American doctors, and sent to pharmacies by American drug wholesalers or distributors, some of the nation's biggest companies.
You have these rogue doctors prescribing incredible numbers of opioids. You have the pharmacies dispensing large numbers of OxyContin and hydrocodone. And then you have the drug wholesalers, which are shipping from the manufacturers to the pharmacies.
Tommy Priest has lived in Kermit his whole life. He's served on the town council for 17 years. He's now chief of the volunteer fire department.
It's a great life growing up here in a small town. Everybody knows everybody.
But prescription painkillers transformed Kermit.
My generation, when we growed up, we looked back and the kids wasn't out playing no more. They wasn't doing nothing. I guess they was really afraid to come out.
There were some robberies. There were some people that were robbed and, you know, what have you. But it was just not a safe place to be at the time when all this was going on.
Prayers, a windshield cutter.
At the fire department, Tommy Priest found himself responding to more and more overdoses. Many times, he and his men would arrive too late.
It's a terrible feeling when you go in and you know you can't revive somebody and help them. It is. It's a bad feeling.
Priest knows that feeling intimately. In 2005, his younger brother got a prescription for several large doses of OxyContin.
They feel it. No question asked. You know, they feel it for him. And 2 days later, we get a phone call. My brother's laying in a trailer down here in Wayne County dead. He OD'd on the OxyContins. And I've never heard of anybody giving anybody 4 80-milligram OxyContins per day. That's something else that I've heard of. And it was really a big loss to lose my brother. I mean, him was close.
No state has lost more of its people to drug overdoses than West Virginia. Law enforcement has cracked down on pharmacies around the state, including the one in Kermit that received 9 million pills in 2 years. Its owner was fined and sent to prison. But in West Virginia, until recently, the distributors that supplied those pharmacies with millions of painkillers have largely escaped consequences.
Every drug that they distribute is to a licensed pharmacy. And every prescription that the pharmacy fills is from a licensed doctor. So they say, hold on a minute, we're just the middleman.
According to an investigation by the Charleston Gazette-Mail, drug wholesalers shipped 780 million oxycodone and hydrocodone pills to West Virginia between 2007 and 2012. During that period, over 1,700 West Virginians fatally overdosed on the same two drugs. Under West Virginia law, distributors are legally required to report pharmacy orders that seem suspicious.
The quantities of the opioids were increasing dramatically that were shipped from the wholesalers to the pharmacies. That should have sent signals to the distributors.
West Virginia sued the distributors for failing to raise red flags about the number of painkillers flowing into the state. During the previous 12 years, the state received just 2 suspicious order reports. In the years since the lawsuit was filed, that number shot up to more than 7,200. The state just settled with 2 of the biggest distributors, which agreed to pay a combined $36 million. Neither admitted to any wrongdoing. Now the town of Kermit is following the state's example, suing 5 drug distributors for damages.
If we don't get anything out of this suit, monetary, maybe we can get the fire started and keep it going where it grows bigger, and we can get other people involved in other towns.
That fire already appears to be spreading. Late last year, the county next door sued three of the drug wholesalers. McDowell County was shipped more than 12 million painkillers over a six-year period. It has the highest rate of fatal drug overdoses in the nation. In the county seat of Welch, 80 miles from Kermit, Mayor Reba Honaker just filed her own lawsuit against the drug wholesalers.
I'm here to file this.
Mayor Honaker wants to hold the wholesalers accountable for their role in the opioid epidemic that has devastated West Virginia.
I would love to see the drug companies take responsibility for the number of drugs that they send into our city and our county.
I'm joined now by Dr. Anna Lemke, Chief of Addiction Medicine at Stanford University, author of Drug Dealer MD, How Doctors Were Duped, Patients Got Hooked, and Why It's So Hard to Stop. Doctor, if you look at any of the data, that chart we showed about opioid overdoses, there's just something crazy that happened about, I don't know, 8 years ago in this country in terms of opioid consumption. What happened?
Well, it really began in about 1980. Prior to 1980, doctors were very reluctant to prescribe opioids for pain because they were concerned about patients getting addicted. But in 1980, there was a huge shift in medicine, and doctors started prescribing opioids for minor pain conditions and chronic pain conditions. And a major driver behind this was the pharmaceutical industry. But in order to really understand how this happened, it's necessary to realize that the pharmaceutical industry used a Trojan horse-like approach to infiltrate what I call big medicine. Basically, the pharmaceutical industry behind the scenes launched a covert operation, in essence, to influence academia, to influence the FDA, the Federation of State Medical Boards, the Joint Commission. These are watchdog organizations that are supposed to keep an eye on how doctors practice. And the pharmaceutical industry ended up perpetrating one of the greatest myths in modern medical history, which is, if a patient is prescribed an opioid for a pain condition, they won't get addicted.
Right.
And now we know that's not true.
So you've got the big pharma, you've got the distributors who are the sort of wholesalers in this story, who are the ones who are the targets of the lawsuit. This, you've got doctors doing prescribing, huge amounts of pain pills flowing into the American populace. I guess my question for you is, in places that have seen a lot of economic devastation, how much is this a story about the specific nature of opioids? How much is it a story about essentially economic desperation leading to addiction?
It's a great question. Karl Marx said that that religion is the opium of the masses. And I think today we've reached a new era when essentially opium has become the religion of the masses, which is to say, we have so wrenched our social fabric. We have communities that are devastated by unemployment, devastated by multi-generational trauma. And these are communities in which people are particularly vulnerable to becoming addicted. And when you then also add to that poor access to quality health care, and you've got doctors who are prescribing opioids simply because it's all they have at their disposal,
right,
to target pain, they don't have access to other resources, you have a perfect setup for addiction.
So one of the things that is so horrifying about those numbers on overdoses is you have addiction is one thing, and then you have people dying from the addiction.
Right.
And there's one story that people tell that basically the kind of restraints on pain pills that we started to see reform that lowered the prescription, started monitoring it, that people then moved to things like heroin and even more dangerously fentanyl, which is a synthetic, and that move from prescription pills to things in the black market is part of what's driving the overdose epidemic.
Certainly it's true that many individuals begin with pain pills and then transition to heroin, but it's not clear that this transition is because they can no longer get the opioids they need from a doctor. What's more likely happening is that in the general populace, people are exposed to opioids through a doctor's prescription or a friend's prescription or a family member's prescription, and hence get a taste for opioids and then quickly transition to heroin because it's cheaper. In other words, the crackdown on excessive opioid prescribing is not driving the increase in heroin use. It's simply that we have now created a nation of people who are addicted to opioids.
How do we solve it?
Well, one of the ways that we have found to be most effective looking at communities around the country is when many different stakeholders within the community come together. For example, volunteer firefighters, the criminal justice system, the school system, the medical community. When all of those different factors and people from different stakeholders come together and try to rebuild their community from the inside, including getting affordable and immediate access for patients who have become addicted, then we see better results.
All right, Dr. Anna Lemke, thanks for
joining. So please, before you make judgments on people who are suffering, not for days or months, but for decades, please understand they are not like a Donald Trump. But that's also, I could take you down to the bayous of Mississippi and Louisiana. I could take you to the plains of Texas. I'm also a resident of Texas and have the for years at the Healing Springs Ranch there in a little tiny town of Tioga. You get to know people when you're a part of their community. It's just there's so much judgment, so many name-calling. It's unnecessary. By the way, for those of you who are interested in changing your health, I'm going to be doing men's and women's health series on upcoming programs. Not just a little piece, but like a half hour on particular conditions that can help you. Pass on the information. We have over 300 video clips on our YouTube page. We have hundreds of articles published every day or two on Progressive Radio Network page. Share them. Share them through word of mouth. Share articles and share videos. It can make a difference. Thank you all for listening today. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Tonight, the Progressive Commentary Hour, a top CIA analyst for 17 years, person that was in all these dark operations, and we're going to find out the truth. Have a nice day, everyone.
To our God. I don't care how you're feeling right now. Sing hallelujah.